Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the escalating violence in Ukraine ahead of Sunday's election and examine the extent to which Vladimir Putin has lost control of the pro-Russian thugs he organized in eastern Ukraine while he rides the tiger of media-driven nationalism at home. Anders Aslund, a former Swedish diplomat who served as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia, Kyrgyzstan, and Ukraine, and is co-chairman of the board of trustees of the Kiev School of Economics, joins us to discuss the likely election of the so-called chocolate king in the first round of elections and what Putin's next move is likely to be after an election he had hoped to prevent provides legitimate leadership for Ukraine. Then we'll examine the latest military coup in Thailand, the 12th since a constitutional monarchy was put in place in 1932. Gerald Fry, who has written extensively about Thailand and is the author of the definitive book on Thailand, A Historical Dictionary of Thailand, joins us to discuss the political polarization in the country between the red shirts and the yellow shirts and whether the military might side with the more conservative minority of yellow shirts against the majority of red shirts and their deposed brother and sister populist leaders. Then finally, following Secretary of State Kerry's remarks in Mexico on Wednesday expressing frustration with the Venezuelan government's total failure, quotes, to talk with the opposition to resolve the country's increasingly violent political crisis, we will speak with Rory Carroll, the UK Guardian and Observer's Latin American correspondent in Caracas, Venezuela. The UK Guardian's former Latin American correspondent in Caracas, Venezuela, and author of Comandante, Hugo Chavez's Venezuela. We'll discuss the failure of the talks brokered by Venezuela's neighbors and the Argentine Pope's special envoy, and growing congressional pressure to impose sanctions on the Maduro government that are likely to be spectacularly counterproductive. And joining us now is Anders Aslund, who's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and co-chairman of the Board of Trustees of the Kiev School of Economics. He worked as a Swedish diplomat in Kuwait, Poland, Geneva, and Moscow, and served as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia, Kyrgyzstan, and Ukraine, and is the author of How Ukraine Became a Market Economy and Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anders Aslund.
Thank you very much.
And the Sunday's elections in Ukraine, of course, are vitally important, but it looks as though from this latest incident where I think 11 Ukrainian soldiers were murdered at a checkpoint by these pro-Russian nationalist, self-declared republic types who have basically said, we are not going to allow this election to take place in Donetsk because we are now an autonomous region. Is this a portent for things that might get ugly on Sunday?
I'm afraid so. The number of soldiers killed in this incident has now increased to 16. But what we are seeing is ever more terrorism carried out by Russian-supported criminal gangs, so, which means that they have no possibility of getting the people with them. We're also seeing that these gangs fall out with one another and try to kill one another, and one after another they flee to Russia. And in Ukraine, traditionally there is very high participation. The opinion polls suggest that the participation will be about 70%. And the two regions as a whole account for 14% of the Ukrainian electorate. So even if these two regions would not vote at all, Ukraine would have quite a decent participation. And as it looks now, Petro Poroshenko, the big businessman, would get possibly over 50% in the first round.
And he's the so-called chocolate king.
Indeed, and he's a person with considerable political experience, 48 years old, strong executive, admittedly a billionaire, but he was part of the Orange Revolution, and he was very much a part of Euromaidan, the protest movement from the very beginning. So he has a lot of credibility.
So do you think that that Putin's having second thoughts about what he stirred up there, that he may have lost control of these pro-Russian thugs in Donetsk and Kharkov and in the east, the so-called self-declared republic, leaders of self-declared republics? And the Russian dissident Khodorkovsky has said, and of course he doesn't have a lot of traction inside Russia, but I think he's reasonably sophisticated about Russian politics. He's warning the West that sanctions against Moscow might backfire, and that's exactly what the nationalists would want. They want more isolation. And Putin, of course, has stirred up nationalism, and I'm not sure. Basically, I have two questions. One, has Putin lost control of his surrogates in eastern Ukraine? And can he control the surging Russian nationalism that he has stimulated?
Well, on the first issue, it looks as if President Putin pulled the plug on the insurgents movement in his statement of the 7th of May, when he said that it would be a positive development if the presidential elections on the 25th of May take place. So then the referendum, which was fake from the beginning to the end, looked exactly like that. And after that, we saw that the separatists seemed to be abandoned, and they started falling out with one another. So they clearly felt abandoned by Russia and President Putin. So my sense is that President Putin has a number of contingency plans, and when he sees how things develop, and if they don't develop well, then he stops. So what didn't develop well, to answer your second question? One is that the separatist movement was not very strong, and it was not impressive. They did not find any leaders of any legitimacy inside the Ukraine, and very little popular support even in these two easternmost regions. And the other point was that the Ukrainians were actually fighting against the separatists, even if it was not very impressive. But then I think that the sanctions against President Putin might have had more impact than we thought. Of course, in economic terms, they meant very little, but the Russian stock market and the other financial markets were badly hit by the threat of more sanctions. So that might have been a reason for President Putin to move backwards. And also 18 of these crony companies that were embargoed by the United States were probably companies in which the U.S. government knows that President Putin himself had ownership. So it does look as if he withdrew. And now what will happen after President Putin has pushed for hardcore linguistic nationalism inside and outside of Russia, that is really a big question for him to face up with the future. So I totally agree with this as a big question that we have to look for the future. As yet, we don't know the answer.
Again, I'm speaking with Anders Asland, who's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and co-chairman of the Board of Trustees of the Kiev School of Economics. He worked as a Swedish diplomat in Kuwait, Poland, Geneva, and Moscow, and served as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia, Kyrgyzstan, and Ukraine, and is the author of How Ukraine Became a Market Economy and Democracy. So turning to the likely winner on Sunday's election, Petro Poroshenko, the so-called chocolate king, the billionaire. My understanding is that he actually has pretty good relations with Putin. So do you think a deal has been done under the table between Putin and Poroshenko?
That we can never know, but I don't think that is the critical thing. Poroshenko is a middle-of-the-road man. He's pro-Western. He's liberal in his pro-business in his statements. I know him reasonably well for about 10 years, and he's very likable. He speaks excellent English, an intelligent and strong person. But he has a big chocolate factory a bit south of Moscow, so he's directly dependent on the Kremlin in his business, and the Kremlin has played all kinds of tricks with him. Currently, the accounts of his company in Russia are frozen, and that's to the tune of $80 million. It's no small money. He's not allowed to export chocolate to Russia because his chocolates are not considered proper from a sanitary point of view, according to the Russian authorities, which is, of course, quite silly given that he exports on a rather big scale to the European Union at the same time, and the European Union with much higher standards, sanitary standards, have no problems. So clearly Moscow thinks that Poroshenko is a man that they can make a deal with, but if it's done already, I doubt that. But it's also probably that he seems to be winning the elections quite strongly, and he's no fool. So then probably the Kremlin thinks that they are better to get along with him.
Meaning, of course, that there won't be a second round, which they could then destabilize. They just, this will be a sufficient victory to get this over with, because clearly this country, Ukraine, desperately needs a stable government.
Indeed. And clearly there is a big risk of continued terrorist attacks supported by Russia from the future. And all the time there are speculations, rumors, evidence about subversive activities by Russian intelligence agencies in Ukraine that one reads about in the Very Good and Free Ukrainian News.
So you think that the Ukrainian people are going to show up? They want this resolved in this first round.
Yeah. What we have seen in the opinion polls is that to begin with, there were three prominent candidates, and then all of a sudden Poroshenko took off, and then he has gained more and more. And Poroshenko is not the person that people would die for. He's not a charismatic great leader. Well, charismatic is, but not to that extent. He's rather a person that everybody sees is good enough from a large number of points of views. And why not make him the favored candidate? And the base, you know, is to stabilize the country, as you say, and then you want to stabilize it as fast as possible. And 3 weeks between a first and second round could be a very dangerous period for destabilization.
So, Anders Asland, in this election then, given what's just happened, where 16 Ukrainian soldiers have been killed at a checkpoint, and I believe it's this self-declared Republic of Donetsk that have taken credit for it, and they've vowed not to allow the elections to take place, will the elections take place in the East, and will the Party of Regions, as far as I know, they're fielding candidates. What's your sense of what's going to take place on Sunday in Ukraine's East?
The latest news is that only half of polling stations can be open because of the local election committees having been intimidated in a violent fashion so that they can't function. So my guess now is that we would see about 7% of the electorate not being able to take place to take part in the elections on Sunday. And of course, this will rather help Poroshenko because he has the least support in the East.
But does this mean that, given this apparent rift between Russia and these pro-Russian thugs that they've organized, and that the GRU and the Spetsnaz apparently in plain clothes have organized these people, so if Putin is trying to cut them loose, would they listen to these Spetsnaz and GRU guys that organized them in the first place? I mean, that's the real question, isn't it? How much has Putin lost control of them, and how much are they rogue elements?
Yeah, I think that they have turned now more into rogue elements. And after Putin's statement on the 7th of May, we have heard very little about these special forces. And it has been much more the rogue elements that have been left behind. So this looks more, these people look more like bandits than organized military force.
And that is why the local people have rejected him, and that was Putin's learning curve, that he stirred up this separatist movement, but then it didn't have the kind of traction that he hoped for and didn't attract the kind of leadership that he could even pretend had some legitimacy.
Yeah, but on the other hand, you can say unrest in eastern Ukraine is nothing that is bad for President Putin. This is what he wanted to have, and now he can have it for free for some time before the Ukrainian law enforcement has managed to mobilize sufficient force to clean it up.
But does he want the territory? My understanding is that Putin, he may be borrowing from Mao Zedong's dictum, it's better to have hegemony as opposed to responsibility. Apparently what they've taken on in Crimea is going to be extremely expensive. And it would seem to me that Putin doesn't want to be stuck with the bills. Conversely, it looks as if the West is going to have to bail out Ukraine and end up paying Putin's gas bills.
Yes, and from what we have seen from the Russian behavior, it's quite possible that they would have liked to move in to and take over much more of Ukraine. But then it turned out to be too costly in terms of Western sanctions and also militarily, that they realized that they would need to use much more force than they had presumed from the beginning. After all, the Crimean takeover was very fast and almost bloodless.
So then Putin basically was deterred by the reality on the ground that, I mean, did he believe his own propaganda and go through a learning curve?
It looks very much as if this has been a trial and error process. We have seen different plans, for example, to take over half of Ukraine, which was a purported National Security Council document. We don't know if it's a fake or not, but probably it is a real document. We have also seen how the Russian behavior has changed. So it really looks as if Russians don't presume that they, or the Kremlin, that it can control the situation, but they start something and then they see what happens, and if it doesn't go well, then they change their action. So what is surprising is how flexible they seem to be, given that the propaganda has been so remarkably hard.
But can they walk back that propaganda domestically? I mean, in other words, I asked earlier about the idea that Putin has unleashed this intense nationalism. And we know that nationalist forces in Russia are quite ugly, that, you know, as bad as Putin is, there are worse people waiting in the wings than him.
Yeah, but the nationalism has been very much pushed by Putin himself. While Putin complains about neo-Nazism and fascism in Ukraine, neo-Nazis were allowed to demonstrate in at least 20 different places in Russia on Victory Day, the 9th of May, and the Nazis are simply favored by the Kremlin today in Russia. President Putin has developed very good relationships with all kinds of hardcore right-wing groups in Europe, as a clearly neo-Nazi organization, Golden Dawn in Greece, or Jobbik in Hungary, which are the most obvious neo-Nazi organizations we see in Europe today of any significance. So he is playing the nationalist card, and we should not be so afraid of harder people being in the wing. It's Putin who is the hard one.
Well, already we have this peculiar geopolitical hybrid that I don't think we've ever dealt with, and I'm sure it's one of the reasons why the Washington and the White House seem to be caught flat-footed, is you have this amazing hybrid now of organized crime and national security, the mafia and nuclear weapons. And now you're adding to that the idea that they're that politically they're pro-fascist and encouraging these fascist parties around Western Europe. So that's an alarming combination.
On the other hand, you can say this is not very attractive. This is not what you are likely to win a lot of public support for in ordinary time. And perhaps with his very personal sanctions against Putin and his closest men, the United States and the European Union have found a suitable countermeasure to this subversive warfare.
But it's bad enough that Putin is a criminal and one of the richest men in the world in terms of what he's embezzled from the Russian people. And obviously nationalism serves to distract the Russian peoples from his wholesale theft. But if he is also a Nazi sympathizer, that's an alarming development.
Well, the point with Putin is that he doesn't seem to be very serious about these ideas as such, because it comes up all of a sudden. It rather seems to be a speculation, an opportunistic development, and perhaps he will realize that some of his ideas are not very good for his political future. So it remains to be seen.
Sure. Well, just in closing, Anders Asland, if the election on Sunday goes as expected and Petro Poroshenko, the chocolate king, is elected president on the first round and the country is able to stabilize and have a legitimate government, even though the government at the moment is not illegitimate, it is the parliament, but Russia is continually insisting that it's an illegitimate government. Will Russia continue to destabilize it or will it give it breathing room? I mean, I just don't know what Putin's next move will be.
Nor do I. I think that it remains to be seen. And in either case, it would look as if President Putin is caught with egg on his face. If Ukraine really is a functioning democracy, then the whole Russian propaganda looks very empty. It would be very hard for Putin to recognize Poroshenko as a legitimate president, although it seems now as if it would become quite obvious. And if he continues with subversive warfare in Ukraine in one way or the other, then he will get a continued very strong reaction from the West and more sanctions that will hurt his economy and therefore his popularity at home. So well, these are two bad choices.
I see. Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Anders Asland.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Anders Asland, who's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and co-chair of the Board of Trustees of the Kiev School of Economics. He worked as a Swedish diplomat in Kuwait, Poland, Geneva, and Moscow, and served as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia, Kyrgyzstan, and Ukraine. And he's the author of How Ukraine Became a Market Economy and Democracy. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the latest military coup, the 12th, in Thailand.
I have breathed all the sea. You're our fan, prophecy. Our destiny we will not hide. When the sun comes up, it will be on your side.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Gerald Fry, who is a distinguished professor of international and intercultural education at the University of Minnesota. He served as a Peace Corps volunteer in Thailand and went on to do doctoral work in international development education. He wrote the recently published definitive book on Thailand, A Historical Dictionary of Thailand, and is currently working on a book called The Thais, The Bamboo and the Lotus. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gerald Fry.
Good to be with you again.
And the coup now in Thailand has been officially announced as you know, they've acknowledged what it is. It was clearly a coup from the beginning. The military were a little churlish about calling it a coup, but now they're calling it a full-blown coup. And this is one of many, isn't it?
Yes, this is the 12th successful coup since the shift to a constitutional monarchy in 1932. There have been a total of 23 attempted coups, and this one was the 12th, which was successful, and apparently without any loss of life or bloodshed. Many of the Thai coups, in fact, the great majority of Thai coups have been very peaceful.
But this one, some of them have been, most of them have been in the real world in terms of democracy. None of them are justified, and most of them haven't been justified. But this one arguably could be justified because the red shirts and the yellow shirts seem to have completely polarized the country. They have armed encampments, and they're ready to do battle on the street. So it seems like some adult supervision was necessary.
I think the military was very patient. This has been going on now since November, and the economic consequences are increasingly negative for Thailand and its economy, its tourist sector, with this political instability, a government that was a caretaker government with no parliament that really could not act decisively on matters. So I think the military was reluctant to act, and then finally, and then they had 2 days of discussions after the declaration of martial law to try to reach a compromise to move forward. And I think they stepped in, and I think probably many of the people in Bangkok, especially those of elite background, are probably happy. This is seen as a victory for Suthep and the protesters, and they represented not the majority of Thai voters, and that's the sad part of this. It's not democratic, but on the other hand, they call themselves the National Peace and Order Maintaining Council, so hopefully this will mean a peaceful situation. And then I think how the Reds will react, the red shirts who are obviously very disappointed. I had many emails this morning from friends in the northeast of Thailand who were very disappointed with this coup d'etat. But I think a lot will depend on how this new council, the military council, what kind of government it installs and whether it represents both sides of the political divide.
So the government then of the former Prime Minister, Yingluck Shinawatra, who is the sister of the exiled billionaire former Prime Minister, right, Thaksin Shinawatra, and they represent the Reds, who and their political base is in the north and in the country, and the Yellows are in the rest of the country, particularly in the urban areas. They tend to be the more educated, at least if that's the best way to describe it. And you're suggesting that they're the beneficiaries of this coup, and that the people, the red shirts, are disappointed. Is there any likelihood that the military will try and install a yellow shirt government?
If they do that, that's going to be a huge mistake. And these days, actually, the people that wore yellow shirts before are not wearing yellow shirts anymore, and so that's the group. But they're now wearing white, and a lot of the colors of Thai nationalism, red, white, and blue. So they've changed they don't really wear the yellow shirts anymore, but it's basically the same group. People who tend to be of not always, but often of elite background, highly educated. Though many of the people in the north and northeast now are also well educated, so it's a mistake to consider them. Charles Kais just wrote a wonderful book about the northeast, Finding Their Voice, which points out how the people in the north and northeast are now much more educated and cosmopolitan.
So then what are the divides between the Reds and the Yellows? What distinguishes one from the other?
I think the polarizing issue is Dr. Thaksin and his sister Yingluck and the Pua Thai Party. Many people in the north and northeast, and that's the large majority of the Thai country, support Dr. Thaksin and Yingluck and their populist policies. Many people in Bangkok, people in the upper part of the south, on the other hand, don't like, they just hate, have tremendous contempt for Thaksin and his sister, and find them very corrupt, highly critical of the Western media for overlooking the corruption and many of the, what they consider, bad aspects of Dr. Thaksin and his sister Yingluck. So many Thais are upset with the Western media coverage. But as I said, I got many emails this morning from close friends in the Northeast who are very They said this was a really sad day in Thai history.
Again, I'm speaking with Gerald Fry, who's a distinguished professor of international and intercultural education at the University of Minnesota. He served as a Peace Corps volunteer in Thailand and went on to do doctoral work in international development education. He wrote the recently published definitive book on Thailand, A Historical Dictionary of Thailand, and is currently working on a book called The Thais, The Bamboo, and The Lotus. So to get an idea of Thaksin and his sister, whose government is basically been overthrown by the military, and to understand these passionate feelings for and against him, when you say he's a populist, he's also a billionaire. Is he kind of a liberal version of Rupert Murdoch?
It's hard to describe him. He's clearly a populist, has carried out many, many populist policies, which people in the North and Northeast, many people in the Northeast have very much liked. But the people protesting in Bangkok, the group you described as Yellow Shirts, really have tremendous contempt for Thaksin and his sister Yingluck and the Pho Thai Party that represents their interest.
But doesn't he have huge media holdings, among others? And what's the status of his television network?
Oh, he came to wealth through his dynamic activities as an entrepreneur, a business tycoon in the telecommunications area. And I think many of his telecommunication businesses are still operating and very successful.
But are they able to operate? When I use the Rupert Murdoch analogy, that he's a liberal Rupert Murdoch, is he able to operate a liberal Fox News in Thailand?
I think in terms of his populist policies, I would just describe them basically as very populist. There was the health scheme with universal health care available for minimal cost. There was one scholarship for every sub-district in Thailand for the brightest kid in that district to have the chance to study abroad. Then there was this rice pledging scheme, which was very populist, but there were flaws in its implementation, which got Yingluck in trouble. Also, by the way, I was just in Thailand, and Yingluck had already been deposed by a judicial coup d'etat. She and nine of her cabinet members had violated the Constitution, so she was no longer a prime minister when this coup occurred. It was another member of her political party, his name is Niewit Thamrong, who was the prime minister, caretaker prime minister, who was overthrown by this military coup.
So just to try and pin down the objections and the Yellow Shirts, even though now they're wearing the more patriotic red, white, and blue colors. And, of course, we know that the royal family has an immense influence in Thailand to the extent that there are even laws against insulting the royal family. And when you talk about Thaksin and his deposed sister as populists, isn't there, at the end of the day, they have more supporters than the so-called Yellow Shirts, don't they?
Oh, yeah. Every election that's been held since 2001, the people supporting Thaksin or Yingluck, they've won every election. And one of the elections was the biggest landslide in the history of Thai politics. So these populist policies have been very popular in the North and Northeast. And also, people forget there are also many people in Bangkok of working class background or maybe even lower middle class background, and people in eastern Rayong, for example, eastern Thailand, who are also very supportive of the Yingluck and Thaksin.
So
it's not just the people in the North and Northeast. And also there are people, I interviewed a woman in Chiang Mai who I expected, because she was from Chiang Mai, would be very supportive of Thaksin and Yingluck, and she was not at all supportive.
But
there's a lot of, there's more diversity among both camps than people realize.
But if the populists, the red shirts, have the majority and have popular policies, and the military is sort of, you know, siding, at least not overtly, but siding with the Yellow Shirts, do they represent then the kind of conservative reactionary forces? Certainly the military does, but would that be the way to try and, you know, characterize the polarization?
Well, I think what's going to happen is we're going to have to watch very carefully the nature of the government appointed, the nature of the Constitution drafted, and the kinds of reforms they carry out. To what extent, if they're clearly just favoring the so-called yellow shirts, and then there could be some very strong reaction from the red shirts.
And
so we don't know yet how they're going to act. I would hope in 2006, after their military coup, they appointed a cabinet that's been called Old Ginger. They were older people and did not gain a great deal of respect throughout the country. So I hope this new prime minister and this new cabinet will hopefully be very committed to be very honest, have great integrity, and really have a cabinet that represents both sides of the political arena.
But it would seem to me that Thaksin is not going to go away, and his popularity and his sister's popularity. He's in exile, is he not?
He's in exile. And I think the military have asked all the Putai, the current cabinet ministers, to report to this military peace and order maintaining council. And so they were asked to report to them. And I think the leaders of the other side have also been asked to report. So my guess is those people will be released. I noticed that one person associated with the red shirts, the army had come to her house, and that the father of that family is now under detention by the military. There's great concern about, especially my friends in the media, about the clampdown and the censoring of the media, control of the media, the suspension of the Constitution. There cannot be any meetings of people, of any groups greater than five people, for example.
Well, Gerald Fry, thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's good to be with you, and I hope somehow this is resolved peacefully and that the new government is going to be a government that represents Thai people broadly.
Well, I share those sentiments, and I thank you again, Gerald Fry.
Okay, thanks for inviting me. Bye.
Bye. Again, I've been speaking with Gerald Fry, who's a distinguished professor of international and intercultural education at the University of Minnesota. He served as a Peace Corps volunteer in Thailand and went on to do doctoral work in international development education. He wrote the recently published definitive book on Thailand, A Historical Dictionary of Thailand, and is currently working on a book called The Thais, The Bamboo, and The Lotus. We're going to take a brief station break and back, looking into the failure of talks between the political opposition and the government of Venezuela amid increasingly violent political protests.
Otra la sana, caballo viejo se encuentra, el pecho se le desgrana y no le hace caso a falseta, y no le obedece a freno ni lo paran falsas riendas.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Rory Carroll, who up until recently was based in Caracas, Venezuela, as the UK Guardian and Observer's Latin American correspondent. He's the author of Comandante, Hugo Chavez's Venezuela, and is currently the West Coast correspondent for The Guardian.
Yes, hi, Ian.
So what's happening in Venezuela now that the Secretary of State last Wednesday in Mexico City expressed impatience with the Venezuelan government over its what he calls its total failure to show good faith in talks to resolve the country's political crisis, talks being conducted by the Union of South American Nations, UNASUR, and they're specifically being guided by Colombia's foreign minister and the Vatican Secretary of State, who was just appointed by the Argentine Pope. So it seems like the neighborhood is interested in trying to resolve the political crisis in Venezuela. Is the Maduro government?
Yes, although unfortunately there's a dangerous polarization in Venezuela. There's little sign of either the government or the opposition coming to really any form of agreement. And what that leaves us with is a very dangerous stalemate with extreme ill will on either side. And meantime, sporadic street battles between protesters led by university students and the government side, represented by National Guard and these kind of motorbike militias that roar around cities clashing with these protesters. So it makes for a very tense stalemate. And which what makes so many outsiders just so worried. And unfortunately, the intervention of the Vatican and of neighboring states in South America has not bridged that divide between the two sides. And so we're just left with increasing anxiety over the future of Venezuela.
Well, Secretary Kerry last week in Mexico City said that he was not undertaking any action, but the Senate has passed this bill, which he's trying to keep at bay. I take it as some kind of leverage. But is that really going to work with Maduro and his government? Wouldn't the U.S. imposing sanctions on Venezuela just feed into the anti-American narrative?
Yes, it would, exactly. And that's why I don't think it would work. And I also think it's perhaps quite unlikely that the U.S. will in the end, really do it. Because there's no question that Venezuela will continue exporting oil to the United States, and the United States will continue buying Venezuelan oil. And that's really what matters economically. And I don't think either side are going to threaten that, despite no matter how bad the rhetoric becomes. So what we're left with is the United States kind of toying the idea of tinkering with some sanctions targeted against a few individuals linked to Maduro's government, maybe similar to what they've done with Putin's, Vladimir Putin's people. But, you know, the Americans know that this would just could serve to strengthen Maduro because he needs the legitimacy of being seen by his own side as making this kind of valiant battle against the Yankee superpower. Now, this was a narrative that Hugo Chavez perfected over 14 years of power. And Maduro needs that because he's got an economy that's in a shambles. He's got his own ranks of Chavismo are quite divided. And so he would be rather a gift for him politically for the United States to serve up on a plate this renewed narrative of the big bullying gringo power. And John Kerry knows this, so I think that's why the Americans are really, they're saying this, but whether they'll actually really follow through on it is another thing.
So in terms of the anti-government demonstrations that began in February, and at least 42 people have been killed and more than 800 injured, and about 3,000 people have been arrested, and apparently about 200 are still behind bars. What is the sense that there will be a resolution? It does seem, in many ways, to look like class warfare. The poor support the government, and the middle class, even though they're not sort of American middle class, you see pictures of the rioters and the students. They don't look particularly prosperous, but they're certainly highly motivated. You mentioned the polarization. Is this just something that can't be bridged?
Well, Venezuela has been intensely polarized for about 14 years, really, since 2002. And so it's just sort of the normality there is that there's two sides who despise each other, have completely competing different views of Venezuela, of its history, and of its future. And this occasionally, you know, leads to, you know, to clashes in the streets. Now, and it seems to me that these protests in the street have shown extraordinary longevity, and that it shows that especially it's been really driven by university students and by the middle class, which feels that it's been completely squeezed, and they feel that they have the economy, and basically the slow motion unraveling of the economy has stripped away the kind of basic benefits that the middle class people were used to having. And so the middle class are angry. Now, meantime, the poorer sectors, especially the urban poor, still retain some loyalty to the government, because the government is, this is like a petrostate, and it has huge powers of patronage, and there's a very, very slick machinery of populism. And so it is able to kind of co-opt many sectors of the poor part of the population by giving them by jobs, by subsidies. And even though the government's mismanagement has led to huge levels of inflation and murder rates and shortages of basic goods in the shop and the stores, now all of these problems afflict the poor more than most. But ironically, the government's populism campaigns are also unduly beneficial for the poor, which retains a degree of loyalty, which is why these protests so far have not really mobilized the urban slums. And that, so far, is what saved the government's bacon. Now, the question is, looking ahead, is, well, how long can the government go on like this? Because the economy just shows signs of just continuing its nosedive, really. And, you know, the inflation and shortages and just basic dysfunction and chaos in the economy are chronic. And this is not leading to collapse, because as a petrostate, they still have lots of money, but it is the fact that it's almost like an anarchic economic management means that there are ever more kind of holes sprouting in the economy.
Again, I'm speaking with Rory Carroll, who up until recently was based in Caracas, Venezuela, as a UK Guardian and Observer Latin American correspondent. He's the author of Comandante, Hugo Chavez's Venezuela, and he's currently the US West Coast correspondent for The Guardian. And it does seem, Rory, that Venezuela itself has been shuffled to the side in terms of the world's attention, I imagine largely because of so much attention is now being drawn to Putin and his activities in Ukraine. I did read last Tuesday a piece by your colleague in Caracas, Virginia Lopez, about the Venezuelan Postal Service having indefinitely suspended international mail deliveries. And this is tied to the disputes, the government of Maduro's disputes with international airlines over currency controls. So that certainly seems to be a fairly significant indicator of economic chaos if you can't mail letters abroad.
Yes, I mean, that just shows that really it's become faulty towers on the Caribbean. The fact that you cannot, it's so difficult now just to get basic flights in and out of the country, and to do almost any basic thing, be it kind of banking or importing anything, is just extraordinarily difficult. And so that's why if you visit some of the factories, for example, in Ciudad Guayana, which used to be this industrial heartland, the factories are all kind of cavernous and empty and rusting. You go into the fields of Venezuela, which is very kind of lush, tropical land and ought to be a breadbasket, and yet a lot of fields there are just kind of withering for want of spare parts. You know, people can't get the tractors, they can't fix tractors, and also price controls kind of strangling local production. And so what you're left with is really like an economy that's just hollowed out, and this has been an incremental process over a decade, really. And so we're now seeing this unraveling. And yet just to stress that this doesn't mean Venezuela is at the point of collapse, because although it's got among the highest inflation rates in the world, the government still has lots of money. It's a petrostate. Oil prices remain extremely high. And so they can keep stuffing petrodollars into the cracks and to keep kind of shoring up this rather ever more dysfunctional machine that is Venezuela. And for the opposition, I mean, for them, what is a real source of heartache is that their protests happen to coincide with this great drama in Ukraine. And Venezuela's crisis, really, in terms of news values, cannot compete with the kind of geostrategic value of what's happening in Ukraine. And so that's why the protests and this economic unraveling really have been very much overshadowed in the headlines over the past couple of months. And so then a lot of Venezuelans feel that they're just kind of like an afterthought on the international agenda.
Well, but Rory Carroll, just in terms of the day-to-day reality, the idea that you can't mail letters abroad because the international carriers, I guess, according to the International Air Transport Association, Venezuela owes around $4 billion to international carriers, which are obliged to sell tickets in the local currency, which, of course, is beset by inflation, which makes it very difficult for airlines to purchase tickets because there's sometimes some delay in the time that you redeem the purchase or use the purchase. So Lufthansa is no longer selling tickets. Alitalia is suspending flights to Caracas. And Air Canada suspended service last February. And Maduro's response to Air Canada was saying, if you suspend flights into our country, we're not going to let you return. So given this sort of, you referred to this sort of faulty towers economy, you wonder why they're even talking about sanctions. I mean, it seems like it's just unraveling on its own.
Yes, but the elite, the government elite, is doing very well because they, if you are close to the system and you have political connections, you can become very, very wealthy because the whole system is so riddled with distortions that this creates huge opportunities for arbitrage and for skimming and to make deals with the government. And that's why it's a whole platoon of billionaires who are called the Boligarchs, which is a cross between Bolivar and oligarchs. And a little bit lower down the food chain, you have other people, mid-ranking government officials, who can also actually profit from the chaos and the distortions in the system. And which just means, though, that it's actually, unfortunately, there's a degree of sustainability built into all this chaos, because a lot of people have an incentive in keeping it going. Which leaves, for example, personally, I'm planning a trip to Venezuela next month, and I'm looking now, instead of actually just taking a plane to Venezuela, I may need to fly to neighboring Colombia and then try hop on a few local planes to get close to the Venezuelan border, and then take a bus and drive overnight on a bus or a car, if I can get one, to Caracas. And this is, you know, this indicative of really Venezuela's slumped ever more into a third world status. And in addition to that, just last week, I had friends from Venezuela who actually managed to come here to Los Angeles, and I accompanied them for a few days. And you should have seen their eyes walking around supermarkets here. They were just going around kind of Ralph's, Pavilions, and regular supermarkets in L.A., and their eyes were on stalks. They just couldn't believe the range of choice. Milk. They hadn't seen milk for months. And seeing coffee, they couldn't see. You know, they hadn't seen coffee. Some of them hadn't seen coffee in weeks. Toilet paper, again, stuff like. And these are scenes that Cubans are accustomed to doing when they manage to leave Cuba. But now, with the fact of Venezuela, which is like a petrostate, and used to be kind of one of the most Americanized states, for good or for ill, inside America, is now reaching this level of dysfunction. It's really quite tragic.
But it does seem that it's the fault of the government itself. I mean, they blame the Yankees for everything. But I haven't found any real evidence that America is trying to destabilize the place. And the old guard, who obviously were involved in and have been involved in trying to destabilize the country, and the sort of Miami crowd that Maduro and his predecessor Chavez always referred to. Is there any evidence of their being successful? I just don't see the evidence that this is the hand of the United States trying to destabilize a country and a government that it disapproves of, but rather a government that's managing to screw things up on its own.
Yes, I think this government is clearly shooting itself in the foot economically and has been doing so for many, many years. And there's no question that America, the United States, I mean, does have a long, ignoble role of toppling democratic governments in Latin America. And certainly the Bush administration gave tacit approval to a coup which briefly removed Hugo Chavez in 2002. So the United States does have a certain kind of sordid history in the region, which is what gives credibility in the eyes of some to Nicolas Maduro's claims of a Yankee conspiracy. But I certainly, personally, have not seen any evidence that, in recent years of any serious U.S. effort to destabilize the government, because they basically know two things. They know, one, that the Bolivarian experiment, so-called, is sabotaging itself, and secondly, that if they did intervene or seem to be intervening to destabilize it, this would further destroy the United States' reputation in Latin America, which is already at a pretty low ebb. And so I think the Americans know well enough that they should just kind of keep a distance from the fiasco.
So just in closing, Rory Carroll, is there any indications of any kind of coup from within the government that people must be in appalled at these Bolivarian oligarchs, or boligarchs, as I think you call them. There was a rather mysterious death recently of the former intelligence chief who was very, very close to Chavez and in many ways saved his bacon in the 2002 coup that you just mentioned, that Condoleezza Rice and Company gave a wink and a nod to. So any evidence? I don't know what was behind the killing of the former intelligence chief, whether it was the cartels or some intramural battle. Do you have any idea of it?
No, I don't know. I know multiple theories as to in behind that case. And also every few weeks, or certainly every few months, a new rumor of a coup sweeps Venezuela. There is a lot of murkiness in terms of the nexus between the armed forces, the government, and criminal networks. But I think it's extremely unlikely, certainly in the short term, because it would all depend on the armed forces, on the generals, and many of them just have a very, very strong vested interest in having this government survive, because they would be concerned that if this government fell, that they would then be vulnerable to prosecution for drug running, for embezzlement, and a whole host of other crimes, because there's been a sort of a Faustian pact going back many years whereby, the government can turn a blind eye to the generals lining their pockets, and the generals retain, give complete loyalty to the government, which is why we've seen the National Guard and the Army doing the government's bidding over the past couple of months in terms of quelling these protests. And unless some kind of mid-ranking officer, maybe at the kind of major or colonel level, could maybe attempt something, but I just don't think there would be enough a critical mass within the armed forces to support that. So just because the government has been running the armed forces for more than 14 years, and they've been able to, through regular purges and cleaning house, to make sure that they have their loyalists installed in key positions. So, no, I don't think there's any real prospect of a coup in the short or medium term. And I very much hope that there won't be. But it's any time there's a coup in Venezuela, however bad the status quo is, a coup invariably makes things worse.
Well, Rory Carroll, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Okay, thank you, Ian. It's been a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Rory Carroll, who up until recently was based in Caracas, Venezuela, as a UK Guardian and Observer Latin American correspondent. He is the author of Comandante, Hugo Chavez's Venezuela, and is currently the US West Coast correspondent for The Guardian. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.